This is Dave Nimro. You're listening to episode number 684. And as promised, this is an episode about the speech. The speech. What is it called? The Zenith speech? The actual title of the speech is, "This is not my world." The whole first part of the speech is actually kind of just kind of a introduction to the whole idea of the fact that autistic people are weird. Oh, hang on. Let me answer this call. Had to take a phone call there. Excuse me. Back on the road again. My loopy pills that I take, it's indomethacin. I take it for my gout attacks, and I'm just starting one. And does a fantastic job. But let me tell you, I'm loopy when I'm on these things. I mean, it definitely says on the bottle, you know, please don't operate heavy machinery, stuff like that. And of course, I'm having to drive, I'm having to travel. So, woo, I'm feeling good, baby. I hope I don't hit anybody too hard with my car. Let's get back to the speech. The whole first part of the speech is kind of... I hope it is a light explanation of autism that, you know... I don't want to get into the whole thing about the disability side. That's never been terribly interesting to me. I'm much more interested in respecting differences and how people behave about that. I introduced a few new phrases here. You know, I never use the term Zenith, I don't think, in the whole speech. Not that I'm trying to get away from that particular term, but the term itself ends up needing some explanation. It's just simpler to call autistic people, or people who have autistic-like traits, which is the way I kind of steered it. It's easier to call them aliens or strangers I think we settled on aliens. Because that seems to be something that everybody can just almost immediately relate to. Somebody who's just gosh awful different than what would be considered normal. Anyway, so I found myself, when I was making this speech, using it as kind of a platform, especially in the first half of it, to kind of get on to experts and parents about their really bizarre take on autistic people. I blame the fact that there's a lot of money to be made in getting people weird about this stuff. The whole Kirby way of approaching autism is very lucrative, I find. And my whole indictment of it is to say that it's not very respectful of the autistic person themselves. It always has to do with, well, how would I feel if this had happened to me? And what would I want to do about it? And of course, a normal person, the new term I came up with to deal with normal people, it's called their locals. You know, if you have an alien come into your presence, you know, and you wanted to say, well, these are people that are from this planet, you know, I came up with a very simple term. You call them locals. People that are from around here, that they do the things that locals do, you know. Ow. I have to move my knee every now and then, and when I do, I come to realize that even though I've got my loopy pills, my knee still doesn't feel so hot. Manageable, but still in pain. Owie. So anyway, so I came up with the whole term locals, and I like it so much I started to use it. And it isn't supposed to be used as a derogatory term. It just says that you're from this planet. You fit in. See, now that's where it might get a derogatory thing. You tend to be able to work well on this sphere. Now, ultimately, I kind of say that getting too comfortable on the sphere is a bad thing. But let's not talk about that yet, because that's not part of the first part of this thing. I was talking about the fact that parents and experts go to great lengths to try to talk about what, you know, really try to get people hyped up about spending a lot of time, spending a lot of money, putting a lot of just mind share into mitigating autistic traits, autistic tendencies. The whole definition of autism is interesting, because one of the big terms that gets thrown around a lot, and I think it's actually mentioned in the diagnosis at least twice, maybe several more times, is something along the lines of being appropriate. Almost every part of the definition of what autism or Asperger's is gives the word inappropriate. You know, they behave inappropriately, you know, in social circumstances. They have inappropriate, you know, they laugh at inappropriate times. You know, they behave, you know, well, to say, you know, it's all about not being able to read social cues, things like that. Not being able to behave appropriately. So it all becomes a question of what's appropriate. And I find that to be a strange thing to say in something medical, or to say in something psychological or psychiatric, you know. It's like, well, what's this garbage about being appropriate? Who's ever heard about that? That's a weird thing to say, I think. But that ends up being a big issue in the whole kind of saying, well, when is somebody like that? When is somebody autistic or Asperger's? And it really becomes a question of being inappropriate. Now, I have said, you know, one of my big definitions for Zenith, although I don't use the word, I go ahead and bring up the major facet of Zenith in this first part of this speech. And it's about obsession. Because I find that that's another big thing that has to do with these things. I think it is probably the second concept besides appropriateness, not being, you know, when you are autistic, you are not being appropriate. And the other thing is the fact that being obsessed, you know, doing things in an inappropriate manner, one of the big issues of it is saying, well, they just seem to be a little more obsessed than society likes. You know, we don't like it. It isn't appropriate. It needs to be dealt with somehow. We that's the other big thing, is that whole obsessiveness. And what happens is that experts and parents who are under the sway of experts, or who seem to have some kind of, what's the right way to say it? Who seem to profit handsomely off of autism. So I want to talk about Jenny McCarthy as an example. Not a prime one, but somebody who's spending a lot of time. She is co-opting her fame to help her enrich herself better by talking about her young son who has been diagnosed with autism. It's always the funniest thing, and I do bring it up in this first part of the speech about autism really is a childhood disease. It's not a disease. A childhood malady, a problem, disability. Because not because any of these attributes end in childhood. It isn't like you just grow out of all of it. The biggest issue surrounding all this is that after a certain point, it could be years, it could just be when you get weary of doing all the, spending all the money on the books, getting yourself all educated. You may even become an advocate for your child, and blah, 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 blah. After a while, when it really isn't doing anything but sucking money out of your pocket and time away from your life, and you're going, this isn't really doing anything. It's not making my child's life any better. It's like you're on some treadmill. You're putting forth tons of effort, but you're not going anywhere. When you really start to put it into the context of when I look at my child and how their life is what I'm doing really helping them? And when you come back and you say, no, it's not, you start to pull back from all this stuff. You start to come to terms with, this is my child, this is the way they are. The way they is? The way they are. Something. And you start to look more toward that person's happiness rather than trying to make them behave in some kind of socially acceptable way. And pretty much when you start doing that, you start to leave all this stuff behind. And I'm not saying that's true for everybody, because there's autistic people that have really serious other allied disabilities along with it that require a lot of intervention, lifelong intervention. You know, there's people that need wheelchairs. There are people who need communication devices, those assistive communication boards or something like that. And they will need a person to always help them to communicate. You know, ultimately, you can't afford to pay for that long term, unless you live in a place that's willing to do that, which, at least in the United States, really isn't. It doesn't happen like that. We're willing to help people for a time, and we're willing to dump money into people for a time, but not lifelong, typically. When you end up having to do those things yourself as a parent, now I'm speaking right now not as a autism sufferer. I don't really feel like I'm suffering particularly. I'm mostly trying to come to grips with what I can do and what I should be doing and where I need to be. And that's my torture. But I don't feel like I'm, you know, sick or disabled or anything. So there's just things I should be about, and there's other things I shouldn't be about. Anyway, so there's that. So when I say that autism, I think people are actually right that autism is more of a childhood disability. Isn't because I think it goes away in adulthood. I think that as they get older and as the person that is advocating for certain things for their children start dealing with the reality that this is going to be lifelong, that there isn't going to be some wonderful thing that's going to mitigate this, that we behave about differently. We don't go out and bang the drum after a while. You'll see that. Parents who have lived with autism for like more than 10 years, for instance, they aren't drum bangers anymore. You know, and the newbies who just got their child diagnosed and who are now going through the whole thing of trying to deal with the way they feel and things like that, you know, they get really upset at people who aren't, you know, well, why aren't you out advocating? Why aren't you out fighting and trying to get this done? You know, it would really help if we had more of your support. And it's like, you know what? I can't help you because I have to live with this. You're still in the thing of, you're sure that somewhere out there, there's going, you know, that somewhere inside the shell that your child lives in, that you can break through that shell, all of a sudden there will be this wonderful, beautiful, perfect little person that you always hoped for. They're just trapped, and you're going, they're not trapped. This is what your child is. That's the whole concept of Zenith. This is what you are. And the whole point is you need to come to grips with that. I think it's really important to find ways to help these people not fit in with society. I think, and that's the whole gist of the entire talk, is that you don't want to fit in, but you do want to be able to read. You want to be able to communicate, you know. You want to be able to find ways to enrich your life. I think that's where the reading comes from. I think that's very worthwhile. I think that this is a wonderful time for the aliens among us. And we come up with the whole term alien ultimately, and it comes at probably toward the end of the first part of the speech, after we've kind of drug parents and experts through the mud a bit to say these guys are really much more interested in their own feelings about what's going on. It's very hard for them to put themselves in their child's shoes, mostly because their child can't, you know. One of the hallmarks of autism as opposed to Asperger's is that they're nonverbal, or they can't communicate typically, verbally. And people find out that that becomes a real problem for them. It takes a long time until people can start to try to put themselves into the shoes of this person. And separating out your own personal feelings about if this was happening to you, what you would want, and getting right down to my feelings aren't very important here. What's important is, how's my child feel? I don't know at what point, like say for my son Matt, who is formally diagnosed with autism, at what point, I think it was rather on the early side, But I think I have a different outlook for the simple reason that I could probably be diagnosed with Asperger's pretty readily. And I was in a position that it was pretty easy for me to say, you know, here's how I feel. Here's what my experience was as a young person. Or doing all these, you know, interfacing with society, feeling like an alien, an outsider, how that made me feel, and how I didn't want my son to feel that way particularly. But then finding out that, you know, Matt's kind of a force of nature. I think I was to a degree too. A lot of things just really didn't touch me. You know, I didn't have the opportunity to be homeschooled like some of my kids are. My parents, it may have been legal for most of my time in school, but my parents would have never considered it. It certainly wasn't something that I think was ever explored. And I don't know if it really mattered, because I don't want to say untouchable, but, you know, I guess I feel like that what school was trying to accomplish really didn't touch me too much. Some of the bad aspects of it, you know, bullying, stuff like that. When we talk about being bullied, I think my wife was bullied in school. She's very passionate about not having bullying go on. I think that is one of the prime movers of why she homeschools the kids. I mean, I was the instigator of doing it. My reasons for homeschooling our children were mostly philosophical. My wife's reason for homeschooling our kids was because she didn't want them bullied, I think. I'm sure that there were other things too, but it never really, I think, was for Lisa a matter of she didn't like what they were being taught particularly. I was much more concerned about I don't know if I was really concerned about what they were being taught, but by what my kids were learning in school, kind of bad habits of mine. We pulled out Shayna, I think, mostly because she was becoming a chronic liar. And school, hey, I'm sorry to say it, I don't want to be rude, but school encourages people to be chronic liars. And my child was really going in that direction. And part of the reason to homeschool is to stop her from doing that. My daughter, Brenna, wanted to be out. She didn't, I don't think she really had any friends, or she didn't want them. She is a very solitary figure. And I don't mean sadly solitary. I think she's quite content with that. So forced being around other people didn't work for her. So I guess it's more along my lines of just saying, you know what, school isn't providing anything for her. But she can't get anywhere else. So, you know, that's the reason why she got homeschooled. My son Josh, I think it was just because the other kids, most of the other kids have been homeschooled, and it had become kind of a tradition, and we pulled Josh out. I don't think he was really being bullied particularly, although he is a very, very, very tender-hearted young man. And I think the chances of him being bullied, I'm pretty sure he was being bullied, although he had problems with it, because the whole attitude around school is, well, deal with it, you know. We went to an anti-bullying they're starting up a new program in our school. I don't know what it's really called particularly. It's got some kind of weird brand name to it that I don't remember. But it has to do with how do you deal with bullies. I find that interesting because, you know, it doesn't try to end bullying. It tries to help you deal better with bullying. I don't know if there are certain aspects to the program that just weren't discussed in this parent meeting that the school was having that was going to implement the plan. I don't know what else they do. But everything I saw was all about we are trying to make kids more assertive so that they won't be a target for bullies. I don't know if there was anything to do there about, well, how do you really handle a bully? I don't think they ever really got into it. You know, it's like, whoa, this is interesting. You know, I think if a kid's a bully, I think you should send them off to reform school. Now, the public schools have a real problem with that because, you know, there aren't enough reform schools to send those kids. Reform schools are for criminals. Of course, a bully is about two seconds away from becoming a criminal. It just depends on how society looks at it. But we have to understand that our society, and this really works into how the first part of the speech kind of morphs into the second, is the fact of what does our society really teach. The first thing it really teaches, and this has to do with kind of the autism Asperger's type, how we deal with it, is that, hey, the most important thing is not respecting people and how they are. It's about maybe telling people that the only important thing is fitting in. You must fit in, or, you know, there really isn't an or. You must fit in. I think in the past, there used to be ors. You know, you could find other ways of dealing with life besides having to go to school with your peers. Only some people went to school. Then at some time the majority of people went to school, and then practically all people went to school. And this isn't like back in the teens or the 20s. I mean, this is in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. I remember a time when I was young when graduating from high school was something that not everybody did. Now they made a point that it's mandatory. You have to. They find social ways to get it done because I don't think very many school districts have the manpower to go out and hunt down kids that don't make it. It's really easy. If you can convince all employers that they can't hire people that don't have a high school diploma, that's a powerful way to keep people in school. You just can't find a decent job. And there are other social manipulation tools used to convince people that they have to behave this way. Oh, that feels a lot better. Now it's not just a searing pain. I can move my leg. I can feel some, there's still some pain there, but it's not this kind of shooting pain that makes you go, ah, ooh, yeah, in my knee. I'm taking those loopy pills. They're really starting to kick in. I'm going to need to find some food here in about an hour or so that I can, so I can take another pill. Because I want to quickly get to the point to where I'm not feeling any pain. That's where you get to the point to where things start getting kind of put back together again. The whole point is to stay functioning while the attack works itself through. Anyway, this whole thing about you describe autism and autism sorts of ways of being, Asperger's, whatever, in the whole line of, you know, this is all about sitting in. The most important thing is to sit in. When it comes down to even talking about the whole cure, the whole point of the cure is that your child is all of a sudden going to fit in better. Everything that they do is going to all of a sudden just be more acceptable. More, to use a term that got talked about before, more appropriate. You know, it's just a whole question of, do you fit in? And it has to do with our whole kind of social, psychological, cultural bent toward everybody pretty much has to be this way. Or be reconciled to the fact that they have to learn these kinds of skills in order to function now. I think in the old days, I don't know if people were more accommodating of difference. I'm not sure that was true. But we didn't choose to exercise or feel that we had the tools necessary to force people to be a certain way. We couldn't do it. You know, it was back in the days when we had orphanages. Back in the days when we used to have asylums. And more of them than we do now. For people that just didn't seem to be able to face society, we had places for them. You know, of course, a whole lot of them were horrible, had deplorable conditions because we didn't have a social structure to handle those kinds of things. Now they stay in the mainstream, you know. We don't put our handicapped people into big buildings and you know, spoon feed them or, you know, lock them up out of the way. They actually nominally have to function in the mainstream. And that also introduces its own special problems. I'm not saying the old way was better. I'm not saying. But I'm saying that what we choose to do with them now isn't necessarily better. It doesn't necessarily make their lives any better. Just from experience from my son and how his life has been made less satisfying for him, even though, you know, everybody said, oh, everybody will be happier if you're in the mainstream, if you're in the middle of the things that are going on. And you're going, no, because then there's unwritten laws that say you have to fit in, you know, and you will be kind of coerced and manipulated, forced into fitting in as much as you can. And you have to understand how autism and Asperger's and Zenith sorts of people are, people like me, who are composed of many obsessions. The fact that people like us are very you know, our lives are filled with obsessions, either ones that we hang on to lifelong or ones that we hang on to for quite a while, and we end up being little experts about it. Little experts, that's funny. We end up being experts on it. Sometimes professional, usually kind of amateurish. But still, you know, there we are. You know, what happened? I guess that's the crux of this whole episode of the thing. It's actually the kind of final point, and I'll close, is that people experts and parents, well-meaning though they may be, very damaging is what they really are, ultimately, even though they swear up and down, no way, I'm not hurting my child at all, this is for their own good, which I reject completely, is that they twist the obsessions of their children, the obsessiveness of their children, they twist it until that child, the only acceptable way they can have an outlet for the fact that they're obsessional is to obsess in trying to fit in. And I will tell you myself, my experience is that for most of my life, until I actually saw it, and part of me seeing it was actually writing about it in this speech, was the final realization that yes, society demanded, and my parents were willing accomplices in making sure that whatever obsessions I was allowed to have, and I wasn't allowed very many at all, as an adult, since I run my life more as an adult, I can allow myself a few more obsessions than my parents probably ever would. And I'm not going to speak against my parents, or anybody else's parents really, because they're just doing what society has taught them to do. What schools, what government, what society, all those things wrapped up together, tell parents is the most important thing. It has nothing to do with your subjects in school. It has nothing to do with any of that. It all has to do about fitting in, being okay with what's being foisted on you. That's the most important thing of all. And with autistic people, what they do is they twist autistic people until they're obsessed with fitting in too. I spent the whole first part of my life obsessing about how do I fit in. You know, many, I'd have to say almost the majority of quote-unquote high-functioning autistics, Asperger's people, become mini social scientists. Some are pretty dang good at it, you know. I considered going into sociology. My daughter did, because that's what we end up being. Temple Grandin talks about as being the anthropologist from Mars. That's one of her things about it. She acknowledged the fact that she was an alien. She felt like she was from a different world, a different place. But she clung on to the whole part about anthropology, which is, you know, kind of a social science. It is a social science. And it's because we end up getting so anal about, because anal is part of that obsession, about trying to fit in, we become experts on what fitting in looks like. I'm reasonably good at it. I find, although, that the older I get, the harder it, you know, I don't know if it's any harder, but I think I grow more weary of trying to keep up fronts, and I just say, you know, I'm tired. I don't want to keep up fronts. I tend to want to separate myself from people for the simple reason that, you know, it's just more, it doesn't tax my energy so much trying to keep up the facade that I'm required to do. I could do it better as a teenager. I could do it better as a young adult. But now that I'm growing older, it's like, you know what? I just wanna sleep more, you know, or I want to separate myself more from the situation so that I don't have to keep up the pretense every 24 hours a day. Oh, and that's kind of what happens. I think my wife is slowly coming around to it. She's a wonderful soul. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to speak too much poorly about experts and parents and other people who are really trying in a very societally obedient way to help. But they have to understand that when they are helping in that way of saying, oh, I'm going to help you and you're the only real cure for autism or Asperger's that's really offered is that you will fit in better. It doesn't even begin to talk about how the person being acted on is going to feel about it. That's not important. If anybody thinks about at all, it's always in reference to, do they behave like they feel better about it? You know, it never gets down to, how do you really feel? It's exacerbated by the problem that it took me years just to come to grips with the fact that not everybody felt the way I did. You know, not everybody throws up masks all the time, or at least not as many as I do. And when I started to realize that, you know, that was really the first part of my journey, just to say, you know what, I really am different. And people, rude people would say something, nice people come at you and see, and you know, that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is, there are a lot of nice people that say, oh no, you're not different, you're just like everybody else, you're just fine, go ahead. And that's almost a lie. Sometimes I really value crude, obnoxious people that just come up and say, hey, you know what, you're weird. You're just weird, and you're strange, and I don't like you. And it's like, well, that's really rude. And then you say, wait a minute, you know what, they're actually being honest, where other people aren't. Other people are trying to be more accommodating. And sometimes that's helpful, but oftentimes it's really not. Because you'll never realize that you're really different and that you need to probably pursue a different course. Or that different things than the standard stuff would probably work better for you. That never gets explored because you go, I'm just like everybody else, you know, I'm okay. You know, and people are kind of snickering behind your back and saying, no, they're really weird, but you're not going to catch me saying that. And you go, maybe we need to say that. Maybe we need to have that conversation. Anyway, that is the actual crux of this first part of this talk. Now, it doesn't take that long. I think the actual first part of the talk is probably about 15 minutes long. I wouldn't imagine that the talk itself is more than maybe a 25-minute speech. That's it. I'm giving you kind of my background and what kind of informed what happened. And not really just the preparation that went into it, but what I learned as I was going along and writing this, I went, oh, that's an interesting insight. It's much more organic how these things happen, at least for me. But that we need, and this has always been what I've said, or at least for a long time, what I've said about Zenith. When one comes to the realization and says, okay, I'm going to be a Zenith. I'm going to actually respect what I am instead of trying to kill it. You know? Instead of trying to fit in by trying to kill off all those parts about me that aren't appropriate, I'm actually going to try to fit in. That I'm not going to try to fit in anymore. I'm actually going to try to say, there's something good about me. You know, when you get down to the point of where you're controlling and not controlling your obsessions, where you're steering them. You know, it's like having a power boat that's always turned on. You know, There's some people that said, that's not right, turn it off. You shouldn't have a powerboat, you know. You shouldn't have that engine going. We say, hey, if your engine runs 24 hours a day in your powerboat, the most important thing isn't to try to find ways to kill that thing off. The most important thing is to say, how am I going to steer so I actually accomplish something with all this power I already have? You know, just because other people have engines that switch on and off and that they can regulate it, you know, doesn't mean that you have to alter your reality to work the same way. You know, I think of salesmen, for instance. People who really, with a whole ton of energy, really are successful at those kind of things. Could be very financially successful. We have very positive terms for them. Real go-getters. Things like that. And you go, you know what? I think some of those people, I would have to say probably a lot of them, are probably Zenith. Zenith that for some reason, you know, and I'm sorry, some of the best salesmen did so poorly in school that they never graduated, you know. My dad, I think, is a prime example of somebody who can't, you know, who just constantly has energy and needs to be doing something with it. You know, he was an excellent salesman because he just hit those streets. He just worked harder than other people did, and he got the sales, where somebody else would say, oh, you know, I think having 3 cold calls in a day is just about peachy for me because that makes me nuts. Where he would do, you know, 40, 50. You know, he wouldn't let the stuff get him down. He was able to steer what was probably for him a great amount of energy. He didn't try to kill it off, you know. We have drugs that can kind of help you do that, kind of knock you down, sleeping pills, yada, yada, yada. And if you get to the point where you don't do that, you just go with what you've got. And I'm not saying you should always do that. Sometimes that stuff will kill you really young. And that might not be what you want. But anyway, steer those obsessions. We already see that they can be steered because parents and experts get their children, the children in their charge, obsessed with fitting in. I know it can be steered because I know that that isn't an inborn most important thing. That's something that society forces on us from the outside. I don't know if we have much of a control group or much of an experimental group to try and say, what if we didn't try to send the social signal that fitting in was the most important thing in life, which it is in our society. In case you think it's anything else, I'll straighten you out right here. The most important thing is fitting in. If you don't choose to fit in, well, you're toast. Now you may choose to find a way to fit in different ways. You know, that's not optimal. You will be treated like garbage anyway. But society is a little bit better. You know, I think about goths. You know, gothic people that dress in black and really kind of have their own little clique. I find that to be a socially acceptable deviant group. You know. Of course, people say, oh, I'm not socially acceptable. I stand out. I tend to think a lot of those people are probably Zenith. But, you know, they're spending a lot of their time doing weird stuff, not because they need to do weird stuff, but because they're trying to appease society and trying to feel better and trying to deal with with circumstances that they don't have any understanding for, and that society gives no hope for. So, you know, you become a dropout, a goth, or whatever. You know, if you tend to stay in those social systems, you find ways to get as far from the mainstream as you can get away with without being thrown in jail or stuff like that. It's called thumbing your nose at society without abandoning it. And I guess one of my things is to say that we need to abandon it. But I need to stop this here. I need to go on to part two, which is about these aliens, people that are different, can teach you. What we can teach people. This is Jane Emerald. You're listening to The Life Autistic. This is one of those ones where it's like, oh guy, every now and then in the swirl of muck that Jay just kind of throws out, every once in a while there's this wonderful diamond in the rough, this pearl that kind of appears out of nowhere. It's that Zenolith. And you can look that up in your dictionary or online, and you can figure out what being a Zenolith means. I find it very, very... I have found it to be a concept that has really changed my life. Anyway, this is Jay Nemro. The contact email is autism, AUTISM, @quix.us. This has been episode number, come on Jay, 684. Stay tuned for part two, which will be about the second half of the talk, and about buildings. Jay Nemro. Where's my pointer? There it is. Have a great day.